Halo. It just sounds just like the, you know, like, Jogo Jojo. Oh, it's Halo music. Have you not noticed? It's just like, I could see that intro music in a Halo game, is all okay. I'm saying.
Well, all I'm saying is we're the Dark Souls 2, you idiot.
Yeah, don't say that to the listeners. You're really rude. Anyway, how are you going, everyone?
That's really not good. How we introduce the podcast.
Yeah, I know. All right, let's just move right along. So,
my name's Sabu.
And I'm Church.
And we are the Dark Souls 2.
And welcome to the Dark Souls 2, where today we are calling you names and not making much sense. Okay, so the PC version's out.
Wait, whoa.
It is.
What are we covering this week, Church?
Oh, well, the PC version and the Lost Bastille.
Okay, this week, after hiatus, we are covering the Lost Bastille. However, it's an enormous area and we are actually going to cover it in two parts. So this week we're going to cover what we're dubbing the lower Lost Bastille. And next week we will cover the upper Lost Bastille and Belfry Luna and Sinner's Rise. So, what point were you making about the computer there, Church?
The PC version's out. It is.
You're right. The PC version is out and it's amazing. I can't go back to the PlayStation.
Yeah.
It's nothing against consoles. This isn't going to be like console suck. PCs will, but
they do.
It looks significantly better. We already discussed that. It plays significantly smoother. But the big thing for me, now, you play on Xbox. I play on PS3.
Mm-hmm.
For me, the loading screens between areas when you fast travel on the PS3 would take genuinely upward of 2 minutes each time.
Wow.
And so the trouble that I had there was I would accumulate a number of souls and I'd think to myself, I should really go back to Majula and level up, but that's going to take forever to travel there, level up, travel back. I'll just, you know, hold on to them for a bit longer. When I get some more, I'll go level up 3 times. Sure enough, I'd die, lose all my souls.
Mm-hmm.
I think I got to about level 110 in about 80 hours on the PS3. I then got the PC version, and obviously I knew the areas a lot better at this point, so I was going to go through quicker anyway, but I got to like level 95 in 15 hours, I think, because it's like, oh, I've got 3,000 souls. Sweet, I'll take 3 seconds on my nice solid state drive to travel to Majula, talk to the Emerald Herald, get my souls leveled up, and carry on. It's just amazing. It just works. Yeah.
And I mean, the thing is that, like you said, we're not really in the game of bagging consoles. I mean, I don't really
You
think,
are.
Yeah, I don't think console gaming is as good in any sense as PC gaming. But consoles have their place, the living room. But yeah, it's just objectively much better.
And it doesn't stop there. The servers. Oh my God, the servers. Like, I think I had maybe 10 battles on the PS3 the entire time I was playing over the span of more than a month. And the lag was just horrific, like horrific. So on the PC version, genuinely, like I'm loading into a battle with some guys and I'll beat them or they'll beat me and then it'll load me back into my game. And the moment I'm taking control of my character, it's already flashing up a message saying you've got another battle and it's loading that.
Beautiful.
It's just instantaneous. It's amazing. It's so good.
The other thing that comes with PC versions of decent games, at least, is mods.
Correct. And there's not been a shortage this time, which is fortunate, because I was worried that they wouldn't be able to implement mods in the same way they did with the last game. And it's not a game where you can completely change the core files and, you know, make overpowered weapons with a few clicks of a button type thing. That's called cheating. But it is a game where you have a lot of control over textures and the lighting to a degree, which is nice.
Oh, yeah.
Because with this game, as we all know, the dark areas are supposed to be dark, and it just didn't work. Nothing sort of looked right. And already, within the first few days, there was fixes for that kind of stuff. And there's a few different types, which I think we'll touch on quickly. Do you know the 3 different types, Church?
Enlighten me.
Jido Sato?
Yes, generic downsampling tool.
So this is something that you're going to be seeing talked about on the forums quite a bit, Jido Sato, which is a tool designed entirely to downsample the game. And for those that don't know what downsampling is, it just means that you're taking a resolution for your monitor that's higher than the default resolution and then downsampling it to be the default resolution. So you're basically taking more fidelity and cramming it down into these smaller textures, which are going to still play at a native resolution on your monitor, but you're going to have more detail, I guess, crammed in there because it's taking the bigger textures and making them smaller. So that's nice. It injects into the game. So because it is modifying the executable files in some way, you could end up in the sort of sights of Valve anti-cheat engine. So you could get banned for this kind of stuff, but so many people are going to be using it that the ban list will be enormous and there'll be outrage and Valve will have to acknowledge something's going on here and we need to look into it a bit deeper.
Sure. So from my experience modding Skyrim, the difference between injecting and non-injecting mods can also be about how you go about removing problems that come from those mods. Am I right? So if the mod injects, then I cannot just load a previous save because it's altered the executable files that run the entire game. Is that the case?
Doesn't really apply to Dark Souls so much as it did to Skyrim. In Skyrim, some mods, as you said, would inject into the executable file, and they would be a pain in the ass to get rid of because they would be in your save games forever and a day. With this one, it's basically like you just delete the files because they, to my understanding, will inject each time you launch it. So if you just delete the files that come with Jido Sato, then it won't inject the next time you launch the executable.
Oh, that's excellent. Okay.
Yeah, so it's easy to toggle on and off, which brings me to the next one that you're going to hear a bit about, which is ENB. ENB is a series of modifications made by this one guy in Russia, and he has to make them specifically for each game. So you'll find them for like Grand Theft Auto 4 and Skyrim and stuff. And what it does is it, again, injects into the executable files, and it gives you a lot of control for the lighting and the sort of feel of the environments in the game. Excellent for this game. Now, the last one is Sweet FX. This one doesn't inject. So this one is just an overlay that will apply to everything you do in game. So this is even going to overlay over menu screens and stuff like that. So it's the most basic, I guess, but it's the one that I'm using currently because it's very simple. You can press one button, scroll lock, to toggle it on and off. And once you get the settings sort of in a way that you like, it does improve the game significantly.
Yeah, and I got to say, from having watched you play it, it looks really nice. Like, it's actually quite subtle, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's a definite difference. Being able to toggle it on and off makes you see how clearly it changes the way the game plays. It's quite nice.
Yeah, it gives things depth. Like, things in the background are darker than things in the foreground as opposed to the way it is currently, where everything sort of just washes out. Now, both ENB and Sweet FX rely on you finding profiles that other people have made or making one yourself to add the, I guess, lighting that you want for the game. So as time goes on, more modders and people interested in this stuff will release their config files to the wider market, and then you can choose the one that you like that looks the best for you. Some people love a lot of bloom, some people hate it, some people want it to be darker inside, some people want it to be lighter. You'll find the one that works for you and you'll stick with it. But yeah, get into it. Check out ENB and Sweet FX. And if you've got a powerful enough computer to downsample from, like, say, 4K textures to 1080, give Jido Sato a try as well.
Excellent. So, tips?
Just the tips?
Okay, just the tips.
Okay.
So some classes in the game start without a shield. So if you want to play with a shield, the first one is on the staircase down to Hades Tower of Flame.
Some classes start with a weapon that are too strong for them. The one that comes to mind for me is Cleric. It starts with the spiked mace, and I think it has a strength requirement of 15, but you only have, I believe, 10 strength. If you wield it in one hand, it makes your attacks do a lot less damage than what they should. You can dual wield weapons where they have a stronger strength requirement than what you have, and that will multiply your strength by 1.5. When I say dual wield, I mean hold it with two hands. Then it'll multiply your 10 strength to 15 strength, and therefore you can use it with full effectiveness.
In this game, unlike the last game, abandoning your covenant doesn't cause sin. And also, if you achieve a certain level within a covenant, and then you abandon it for another covenant, you don't lose that level. You can come back to it later.
Yeah, because you might get a bit bored and want to try something new, but in Dark Souls 1, you lose a lot of your progress if you go to another covenant. That won't happen with this time. So feel free to play around and join different covenants on the fly, and you're not going to lose anything. It's much nicer.
Absolutely.
And finally, there is an option in the screen settings, which I actually missed on the PlayStation, but I definitely noticed it on the PC. And it's just a nice little touch for those that want a bit more immersion with the game. You can go to the HUD and you can set it to automatically hide. And what this will do is, once you've done toggling your weapons and using your stamina and that, your health bar and your HUD items will all disappear and you'll just get this perfect screen, nothing obscuring your view. You're at one with the environment and it just sucks you a bit more into Dark Souls, which I like.
Hmm. Lastly, if anybody has any tips that they'd like us to cover off that they've discovered or they think are relatively useful, then send us in. We want to see them.
Yeah. So if you've got some interesting tips that you think other people should know or you think there's anything we've missed, let us know. All of our contact information will be at the end of this episode or on our website.
Right. So the Lost Bastille.
Yeah. Main section of our podcast. Lower Lost Bastille.
Bastille.
So what can you tell me about the Bastille Church?
This place is described as being off the coast of Drang Lake. So it seems to me like you're on an island the entire time. And that's kind of borne out by how you get there, right? There's two routes or routes, depending on what country you're from. One of the routes is by air when the birdie takes you. And the other route is by sea when the boatie takes you.
Welcome to preschool, listeners. You are now five. So yeah, that's correct. So we fought the Pursuer on episode, I don't know, three, four.
Maybe, yeah, why not?
And after the Pursuer was the bird's nest that took us to the Lost Bastille. Now, last episode, we actually finished up with No Man's Wharf. And if you remember, we fought the Flexal Sentries on the ship. And the ship also took us to the Lost Bastille through what I will speculate. I don't know. I'm going to call it the back entrance, but it does come first on the travel screen. So maybe it's the official entry. As far as it goes, the Lost Bastille, we just sort of discussed it last week. It was a jail or a holding area for the cursed. As Vendrick was getting more fearful of these cursed taking over the land, he tried to deal with them by sending them from No Man's Wharf to the Bastille to get them away from the rest of civilization and lock them up.
Yes, and we were speculating about whether and when Vendrick may have decided to just ditch them overboard and kill them all. In fact, the cages on the boats seem to contain souls, and that suggests that there were people in there that were killed or drowned or whatever. I initially kind of thought maybe the prison got so full that he decided to just start ditching them overboard. But what I think might be more clever, given what we were saying last week, is that perhaps he realized that killing them isn't the best solution because they just come back from the dead. And afterwards, maybe he started chucking them in the prison. One of our listeners, Mandy, actually contacted us and provided some really interesting insight that we never thought of. I think it's really quite clever. The souls are brought back on a boat in a cage. And we can assume perhaps that Vendrick, like everybody else, was affected by the curse and had a hunger for souls. So perhaps he sends his soldiers out to kill these people in the cages, and that's why he doesn't just ditch them overboard. He kills, drowns them in a cage, brings the souls back up, and then they come back to Vendrick for his consumption, because every undead wants souls. And if you're the king, why would you not use your power to get as many souls as possible? So either way, though, we know what the Bastille is for. At some stage, Vendrick was stuffing it full of undead.
Mm.
It's kind of similar to the undead asylum in the first game in that regard, don't you think?
Was it, though? I don't acknowledge that the undead asylum was being used to hold the cursed.
Well, whether you acknowledge it or not, the fact is that it was full of undead. It was a place made for undead. Undead people are affected by the curse.
But
it's called the undead asylum. It's not called the, you
all
know.
All of Lordran was covered with undead, though.
No, I know, but not at first, I assume.
Yeah, it's possible.
And actually, that's interesting, isn't it? Because we know that Lordran was afflicted by the curse and it existed before Drang Lake. So, and Drang Lake was in the height of power when Vendrick was in charge, and then the curse came about and then there was a problem. So it kind of suggests that either the curse came to this land from somewhere else, or it's kind of cyclical. Because if the curse was killing everyone in Dark Souls 1 in Lordran, wouldn't it just persist? And wouldn't Drang Lake never have a chance to achieve that curse-free power that it once achieved?
Hmm.
Yeah, think about it.
So Bastille. We got there last episode from No Man's Wharf, and where we end up is at the edge of some wharfs or coves.
Yeah, well, it's a jetty or it's a pier or it's a dock or it's a wharf or whatever it is. But the point is, like, I don't know if you mentioned this last time, but you mentioned it to me and I'm jacked off about it.
You mentioned it last time.
Did I? Well, someone mentioned it. Why is it that you get off the boat and you're standing on a pier and the boat and the pier are not connected? So how did you get from the boat to the pier?
Rowboat.
But there's no rowboat.
So, yeah, good point. Jamian, you made a good point.
Row, row, row your boat gently to the pier. If you turn and fail to look, it will disappear.
That was actually amazing. Don't stop that. Carry on.
Do not leave that in.
No, that's staying.
Don't do that.
Oh, man, I'm not going to let you completely derail this entire podcast. Let's get back on track. Right.
Row, row, row your boat, then it is absent. You will search the rest of your life, wondering where it went. Honestly, though, like, those are just so lame. You cannot leave that there. Can we just talk about the Lost Bastille?
There's no way I can take them out. They're too good.
No, they're horrible. Anyway, continue.
So, you end up on a dock, and...
Row, row, row your boat gently to the dock. Once the boat sinks in the sea, you'll be like, what the... Anyway, that was even worse. That was clumsy. Yeah.
I'm crying.
Fuck.
This is going to be a long episode.
All right, let's just cut it. Let's just get moving.
So, you get off the ship. And you walk along a jetty, and you end up coming to an elevator. Now, if you get in the elevator, the first thing you'll notice going up is that you'll see this item, glowing item, on the way up.
Yes.
In this little cave that you can't get to.
It happens a couple of times I've noticed in elevators. You're kind of going up, but on the way up or down, you see an item, and you can't get to it. It's in a couple of spaces in this game.
Yeah, and so you immediately start racking your brain. How am I going to get to it? I found this one. It was a nice puzzle, but it was quite straightforward. So how do you go about getting that item, Church?
Well, you go out of the elevator. The door opens. You go back into the elevator. You step on the little plate in the middle. Quickly walk out. The elevator goes down. As it's going down, step onto the roof. As it reaches the area with the item, step off again.
Correct. What you get to do is pick up a scimitar off a corpse, and then just behind that corpse is a little hole that drops you back down to where the dock was, and you can take the elevator straight back up. So, from there, we head up some stairs, this sort of low-sloping staircase, and there's some more jail cells on the left and right. And on the right, one of the jail cells you can enter, and you'll get a common fruit. Now, the common fruit is used to increase your poison resistance. Not really useful for this area.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's nothing poisons you here, does it?
No, so I guess it's just giving you something to use a lot later, but I didn't wonder why it would be there. Probably nothing to it, but yeah, there's no poison in this area, so you'll hold on to that for a couple more zones and you'll use it a bit later on.
It is interesting, isn't it? Because generally, there's a bit of a theme to the items in an area. Generally, there's a kind of reason for it. Yeah, I mean, you were speculating earlier that perhaps the prisoners smuggled in to try to cure the curse. I mean, it increases poison resistance. I don't know, something there.
Yeah, I sort of thought about that. Like, the prisoners were being taken to this place because they were cursed, and against their will, obviously. So it would have been in their interest to try and cure themselves of the curse, and they may have desperately been trying to find a way of doing it, and they heard that these common fruit were used to increase your poison resistance, and they may have been trying to experiment, trying to cure their own curse. Just a bit of idle speculation, but it's nice. Makes the narrative fit. The item is described as having no taste, which, again, sort of struck me as such a Dark Souls thing. Everything in this world sucks, even the food.
Yeah. So, on your left, in a cell, the exile holding cell's bonfire. So, first bonfire for the area that you'll find by going this route.
Yeah. Now, this area is a little bit labyrinthian, so we'll do our best to try and put a clear image in your head as we go to different sections, but it's going to jump a little bit back and forward, but nonetheless, this is the most logical path I could figure out while describing it to you guys.
Yeah, and if you don't like it, then you think of a better path, and then send it to us, and we'll be really embarrassed we didn't think of it.
Correct. So, from the Exile Holding Cell's bonfire, you can go out to the ramparts and encounter the Hyde Knight, but we're not going to go there yet. So what we're going to do from here is jump from the Holding Cell's bonfire and head to the Tower Apart bonfire. Now, we mentioned this is the bonfire that you end up if you went the Pursuer route to get to the Lost Bastille.
Yeah, so from the Tower Apart bonfire, as you step out, for the first time since No Man's Wharf, you're kind of in some fresh air, you know, you're out in the open. And I think it's got a really Demon Souls-y feel.
I thought so, yeah. A lot of the game is a very different feel to Demon Souls, even Dark Souls was, very different colour palettes and stuff. But I don't know, this sort of reminded me of it with ramparts and the sort of grey feeling to everything.
And the kind of blue backgrounds. There is a particular area quite early on, I think, in Demon Souls that this reminds me of.
Yeah, so sure enough, you walk out onto the ramparts here and you can see again that you've got to see, you know, pretty much everywhere around you. So it does kind of fit with the fact that we're on an island being used to hold these prisoners. Now, going straight forward, you can't. There's rubble in the way and a big drop-off on the ramparts, so you're forced to sort of go left almost immediately over some rubble. And you can go over this rubble and then turn right to end up onto one of the rooftops, which heads back to the ramparts. But if you don't and you go left, it's not quite clear, but you can kind of go around the edge, hanging off the ledge, and you'll pick up a secret item on a corpse around the corner.
And also you'll be able to see a chest down below you.
Yeah, which we'll come to in a second. But this corpse with the item being...
I believe it's a Radiant Life Gem and a large Titanite Shard. The Radiant Life Gem obviously being a larger version of a normal Life Gem, healing you for a greater amount.
Correct. So you'll pick up those items, and as I said, you passed a couple of windows. Now, I suggest going through the windows to get into this next little room by the ramparts. What you'll do is you'll encounter your first royal swordsman, and once you've dispatched him, there'll be a powder keg, which is a common theme for the area. There's these powder kegs everywhere, and once you kill the royal swordsman, you can push this powder keg off the ledge, and it'll drop to the area below, and there's a number of dogs there, and this powder keg will blow up all the powder kegs in the area and kill all the dogs in one nice sort of fell swoop. It's a very handy little trick.
Yeah, and it looks really cool as well.
Yeah. Now, the royal swordsmen, what do we know about them?
So the royal swordsmen were the best soldiers of Vendrick, it seems, who I suppose are in the area to keep order in the prison.
Yeah.
Considering that it would have been a pretty crazy place to be in. And also these guys are the folks that were outfitted initially and probably trained to fight the giants.
So they're described as the bravest men of Vendrick and having the best armor. So they were used to fight the giants, which they didn't do terribly well. But for more infantry or human people, they certainly would be appropriate for this area to keep things in line with the jailers.
Absolutely, especially considering the awesome sword they carry, the Royal Greatsword, which you can actually get by killing them. It's the one that's described as having an undulating blade that draws blood from its foes. And indeed, it does at base level 67 bleed damage.
Yeah, so it's not a bad weapon if you want to get a bleed weapon off the bat without having to spend a upgrade later on.
But it's kind of like, I always think about the history of the weapon, and even in the item description it says that despite the magnificence of this weapon, it was terribly inadequate in the war against the mighty giants. And it's kind of like, well, yeah, that's kind of true, isn't it? You know, all these amazing swords and fantastic armor and well-trained soldiers, and they just get stomped en masse. It'd be like, you know, making wine.
Hmm. So... once you've blown up the dogs below, you can drop down to their little area and go out a door on the left, which leads to that chest that we said that you could see from the corpse with the Radiant Life Gem.
Yes, and the chest contains a key, and the key is very valuable, so yeah, definitely worth getting it early on. And also, the coveted Silver Serpent Ring.
Yeah, it's the antiquated key, and it'll come up a bit later on in the episode, but worth grabbing at this point. Now, the coveted Serpent Ring. This one's interesting. It gives you 10% more souls. And later on throughout the game, you'll be able to pick up the +2 and the +3 version of this ring. And they give you an extra 20 and 30% souls. So you can end up stacking quite a bit of souls
with these rings. Yeah, I think that's excellent.
But the description for the ring is a silver ring depicting the snake, both the servant and manifestation of the god of greed, Zandro. Now, Zandro is a god that we haven't heard of up until this point. It's interesting because there's also the covetous gold serpent ring, which you find a bit later on, which is described in a similar way, except it depicts, or the snake on the gold ring depicts the god of desire, Zinda. So there's these gods that are being described in this game that we didn't hear about in the last game, and it sort of raised a number of questions for me. You can pick up the name engraved ring from Sweet Xiaohua in Majula right off the bat. And the ring allows you to choose one of 10 gods to engrave on that ring. And again, all the gods, never heard of. Whereas the last game, the gods were quite clear. You knew about most of them, Guinevere and Gwyn and all the others that, you know, come up throughout the game. You even fight a number of them. So I was toying with this idea where the gods may be the same gods from the last game, except they were forgotten to time, and so they've got different names, but that didn't really feel right. I mean, the gods should be remembered. Gwyn did an amazing thing. He would be remembered for what he was done and written down throughout history. So, I don't know. I might play around with the idea that there's actually different levels of gods, and while Gwyn was a god in his own right, there were also these serpents from the last game. And the serpent rings from the last game were described as depicting imperfect dragons. And we know that Karth and Frampt were primordial serpents, and they were imperfect, and they were immortal. And in their own way, they were kind of godlike. And they always had an interest in the dealings of man and sort of manipulating and controlling men, which is what Karth and Frampt were trying to do throughout Dark Souls 1, manipulate the chosen undead to do their own bidding. And at the end of Dark Souls 1, if you don't link the Last Flame, you get this ending where you see 10 serpents rise out of the ground and they thank you and tell you that they'll do your bidding and whatnot from that point on. And, you know, where did these serpents come from? We know about Karth, we know about Frampt. Like, where did these 10 other ones come from? So could it be that these are the actual gods of the Souls universe? That these serpents, these immortal serpents, I mean, we know they're immortal, they must still be around in Dranglake's age. I mean, where else would they have gone?
And I mean, isn't that interesting that there seems to be a level of gods above, say, even the Great Lord Gwyn? Because if you think about Gwyn's effect on history, he was around at the very beginning to fight the dragons. He did a fantastic thing for the world in casting himself into the flame. But then ultimately, one way or the other, he is defeated at the end of the first game. And that seems to be the end of his legacy. Whereas these serpents, if the influence we're talking about is accurate, were around at the beginning and around in the first game and seem, it would make sense, to be around in the second game.
I mean, Gwyn and his ilk, they all fled Anor'londo, we're told, when the dark, the mist started spreading. And why would they flee? You know, Karth and Frampt, they survived either way. One of them wanted you to let the last flame go out, one of them wanted you to rekindle it. So either way, they weren't bothered, it seems. They could still survive through it. They're immortal. Whereas these other gods were fearful of that. Yeah,
running from things and they fled.
Nice little stab. So, nonetheless, once you're done with this chest, you head back into the room with the dogs and you can go up a ladder and head back out to the main ramparts where you'll come across the first undead jailer.
Yeah, and these guys I think are really interesting. I think that there's something going on here, and I don't think we've really realized it until kind of right now in my head. So if you look at the undead jailers, they're much, much bigger than a person, aren't they?
Huge. They are, yeah, twice.
Covered in bandages.
Mm.
And they serve a purpose for Vendrick.
Mm.
Okay. So some other things that seem to fit that bill are the Turtle Knights, the old Ironclad Knights, and the Flexile Sentry, yeah?
Correct.
Really big, kind of seem constructed, and we even hear from the item descriptions that we found in the Forest of Fallen Giants, that the old Ironclad Knights were created, it seems, by Vendrick, because one day they just come out of the castle and start hanging out with the soldiers. So what I think is going on is that the Flexile Sentry, the old Ironclad Knights, and the undead jailers are all deliberate creations of Vendrick, and the fact they're wrapped in bandages kind of tells me that they're maybe like Frankenstein's monsters, and that's what kind of Vendrick does. He, when he has a specific purpose that he needs filled, he makes a magical kind of creature, like a golem or some such, to do it for him.
Sure.
I kind of think that might be Vendrick's game. He makes stuff, you know, on an as-needs basis to
maybe do his not bidding. Vendrick himself, but I think we'll come across, or we'll discuss a character a little later in the game that could be an explanation for some of these experiments.
Ooh.
Mm. So, that's the undead jailers. Now, they're, as we described, a bit bigger and covered in bandages, and it's been wondered why they're covered in bandages. You've come up with an explanation. The other explanation is we know a little later on in what I'm going to call the upper Bastille, they do pyros. So I thought maybe they burnt themselves while playing around with pyros. But I like your explanation a bit better.
Yeah, so do I.
These guys have a chance of dropping the Great Machete, which looks like a stick that they've wrapped a machete onto the end with. It's been described as being used to instill fear more than being an effective weapon.
Hmm.
So past him, you head into another tower, which actually holds Lucatiel. So
yeah, Lucatiel of Mira. That's the second time you see her, if you ran into her at No Man's Wharf, which we assume you would have.
Hmm.
Our land of Mira is surrounded by enemies and constantly at war.
There is only one way up in Mira. Join the Order and prove yourself in battle.
My family had little fortune and no name. I was raised to wield a sword from birth. I had swift success on the battlefield and quickly attained respectable stature.
Yeah, so if you talk to her for the second time, she tells you a bit more about Mira. And Mira being surrounded by enemies and constantly at war is how she describes it. Which she then goes into a bit of her background, saying how she joined the Order in Mira to sort of form a name for herself with a sword, because she had no chance otherwise. She came from a fairly poor family that wouldn't have been able to give her very many opportunities in life. So from a very young age, she trained with the sword to be a good fighter. And apparently her skill was recognized quite quickly, and she ranked up in this order for the mirror fighters.
And she's really, it seems, emotionally invested in the idea of gaining recognition. In fact, she even kind of waxes lyrical about the sadness of maybe fading away from memory due to the curse.
She says, "What will come of me when I disappear?" And at that point, she takes off her mask for the first time. And you see that her face is a bit charred and weird in one quarter, and definitely looks like she's cursed. And it seems as though she's trying to hold off becoming undead herself. And she's worried what will happen if she does.
She also gives you an effigy, which is excellent.
Yeah.
I mean, with the patch, it's not, you know, as valuable as it once was, but if you're playing offline or if you can't be bothered in helping somebody out or whatever the case may be, it's good to have effigies laying around. So, out of Lucatil's tower and onto a long bridge. If you're paying attention here, you'll notice that on the outside of the tower that you just exited, to your right, there is a ladder, and the ladder kind of seems to link to the balustrade or the barrier to your right. So what you need to do is, if you go forward a little bit, you'll notice that there's a bit of a ramp where the barrier has kind of crumbled away. You can go up that, up the ladder, and grab an item at the top.
Yeah, which is a large titanite shard. Now, from there, carry along down the bridge. You'll notice on the left that there's another area with some rubble that you can cross over to, which leads to the area boss. We're not going to go there yet, so just keep in mind that you do come across it at this point. Carry on down the bridge, encounter a couple of dogs and a couple more jailers, and we'll get to the last jailer at the end of the bridge. Now, the reason I'm pointing him out is because it'd be very tempting to run up and just attack him, but he's standing right in front of one of those powder kegs, and I'm going to say be careful when you fight him. It might be worth trying to draw him away from the powder keg and fighting him there, because once you've killed him, you want to use this powder keg to push down the stairs, and what'll happen is it'll blow a hole in the wall at the end. And
yeah, sometimes it explodes automatically. When I did it, I had to shoot it with a fire arrow.
Yeah, it blew up for me every time. I was actually surprised watching videos of other people where it didn't blow up, so yeah, I suppose if it doesn't quite get to the end and blow itself up, you might want to push it into place against the wall and blow it up with some fire yourself.
Yeah, and behind that wall is Macduff's workshop bonfire, so the next bonfire in the area. And it's actually really close to the Tower Apart bonfire.
Yeah, it's a pretty straightforward run between the two, but from this side, the reason we've jumped to the Tower Apart from the Exile Holding Souls is because you can't get to the Tower Apart bonfire from any other way but from the bird. So if you come at it from this angle, you just can't get across the rubble to get to it.
Yeah. So you can rest at the bonfire, and then you'll find that there's a crumbled wall. Now, if you go through the crumbled wall, you'll be in a long room with a blacksmith called Steady Hand Macduff.
"I'm Macduff the blacksmith. All I want is a little flame. Flame, dear flame. I ought to fetch a new ember."
He's a master blacksmith, and I don't know, what was the impression you got of him when you first encountered him? I thought he was drunk.
Yeah, he just seems so distracted by fire.
Yeah, I don't know, he's sort of sitting there, looked like he's swatting flies out of the air with a hammer or something.
Yeah, he really wants to be beating things with that hammer. But
why isn't he? That's what confused me. He sat there sort of swaying back and forward, mumbling about flame, not really acknowledging your existence, swatting things out of the air. As I said, thought he was drunk. But what it appears is he wants an ember to sort of carry on his work, I suppose. He likes embers, which allows him to imbue weapons for you a little later on in the game with different characteristics, lightning, magic, bleed, and that kind of stuff. So he's the only blacksmith in the game that'll do that for you.
Yeah, and there's a bunch of chests in the room with him as well that are worth kind of grabbing stuff out of. Nothing too spectacular in there, although there's some good titanite in those chests.
Yeah, 5 titanite shards and a few bolts and arrows, so those that are archers will find much use in this room.
Now, interestingly, he's sitting on a chest, and I didn't notice this at first, but if you light the sconce that is in that room at the other end from where he is and then leave and come back, he likes fire, obviously, and he's then beating his anvil near the lit sconce.
Is that what the kids call it these days, beating the anvil? Yeah, no, you're right. And it's very easy to do because it's right next to the bonfire that you just sat at. So you go to the bonfire, light your torch, walk to the sconce 5 meters away, sit back at the bonfire, and he'll have moved and you'll be able to get the item out of the chest. And what you'll get is some twinkling titanite, which, a little different from the other titanites we've come across so far, it's described as a form of titanite with special power. What cosmic event could have created such a powerful class of titanite?
Yeah, and so twinkling titanite is used to reinforce items that you otherwise cannot reinforce.
Yeah, and even in Dark Souls 1, the description is very unclear as to where it came from. So I'd say this is one part in the game where From just didn't have a lore-y kind of explanation, so they just sort of mired it in speculation.
Yeah, and you also pick up out of that chest the craftsman's hammer, which is described thusly. Looks like a typical hammer, but is in fact incredibly sturdy. Some say it was the hammer used long ago by a famed blacksmith of yore. Who is that?
Definitely Andre.
I think so.
Yeah, I mean, when I heard famed blacksmith of yore, I thought of Andre anyway, just because I love him so much. But if you have a look at the hammer that you get and compare it to screenshots or go back and meet Andre in Dark Souls 1, it looks identical. So I'm sure it's talking about Andre.
Yeah, absolutely. There's also a locked gate in his room, which is kind of pointless because you can just walk around.
I thought that as well. I'm like, why the hell is this gate here that's locked and you don't even have the key for it? Why'd they bother including it? But then I thought about it. I'm like, well, if they didn't include it, McDuff's just trapped, locked in there. So
yeah, that room was only created so someone could bash down a wall and get in there. Unless, well, this is what you didn't think about, you know, up here for thinking.
Yeah.
Maybe in the rubble, there was once a door. You know, so then there's a door there going through the bonfire room into McDuff's room, but then someone knocked down the whole wall because they were too big to get in.
Okay.
Okay, I'm just saying, you know, you got to think about these things.
Yeah, right, sure.
Yep.
Now, I sort of feel like we might have brushed over McDuff a bit. Turns out he's not drunk. He's actually just a bit autistic. You can't just say that. He is. He's described as a master blacksmith and he knows his trade, but he's very unable to express himself because what he's done is he's locked himself away. He's chosen to go to the Lost Bestie. He locked himself away in this room and didn't want to talk to people because he wanted to hone his skill. And so I guess, yeah, he's a hermit and he doesn't have much human contact and he's there to perfect his art and that's all he's interested in. But as a result of being around forges his whole life, he actually has quite an affiliation with the flame, I guess, and he has a love of the flame, which...
Yeah, but I mean, having said that, though, is that a result of his work with fire all his life? I think it probably is, but also you have to understand in the Souls universe, everyone loves the flame. The bonfire is magic, flame is life, the entire history of the world was created when the first flame was kindled, when the furtive pygmy stole the first flame after the fight with the dragons. You know, fire is one of the most, perhaps the most important lore aspect of the entire universe. So perhaps he just has that kind of general kind of, I'm a citizen of the Dark Souls world and I just adore flame.
Correct. So exit McDuff's room and go back to the bonfire. And now we're going to travel back to the Exile Holding Cells.
So after you get to the Exile Holding Cells bonfire, out onto the ramparts, and you'll see the sea on your right. So again, you know, it's reinforcing the idea that you're on an island, which I think is pretty clear. And you'll also find on this rampart a Hade Knight, another Hade Knight. You found one earlier in the Forest of Fallen Giants above, where was it, above Melintia? No, it wasn't. Never mind. You found one all earlier in the Forest of Fallen Giants.
Right next to Nature's Goatsy.
Yeah, next to Nature's Goatsy. He was just minding his own business, but I thought he was hostile, so I cut him, and then he got angry. We had a big fight.
Sounds like your weekend with your girlfriend.
I didn't cut her. I'll tell it to the judge, but I promise I didn't cut her. This one's got a spear, and I didn't fight with him. And the reason I didn't fight with him is because he didn't want to fight with me. I try to play video games as though I were myself, and I just don't go around cutting random people, and I'll tell that to the judge as well. So I just don't get into a fight with the Hade Knights.
I do.
You're a dick.
Yeah, I am, but I don't know. I wonder why they are where they are in the game.
So do I.
They pop up all over the place, and you kind of wonder how they got to the Lost Bestie. Why is he there? What's he doing? He's just sitting on these balustrades doing nothing.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about the history of Hade, Hade fell into the sea a long, long time ago. I kind of think it was subsumed by the ocean even before Vendrick came to power. But either way, a knight from Hade is now found in a purpose-built prison that Vendrick created to deal with the undead. What's he doing there?
And from the last game, you had these channelers that popped up all over the place as well. And that was a interesting point for a lot of players as well. Like, why is there a channeler in the Undead Parish? Why is there a channeler, you know, in these places throughout the game that they just don't feel like they belong? And over time, people discovered that the channelers were actually servants of Seath. And Seath could actually use them as his eyes. He put them in these places throughout the land to look for subjects to do experiments on, and they were servants of him to be his eyes in these areas. And that was kind of like the grand unifying theory to explain why these channelers were popping up where they were. And I feel like in time somebody may come up with the theory about the Hade Knights as well. At the moment I don't have one, but I'm sure somebody smarter than us will.
Yeah.
So the Hayden Knight, they all seem to be really fast. This guy just flurries you with attacks from the spear, and they have really quick recovery time, so they can prove quite a difficult fight if you're not prepared. But sure enough, if you dispatch him, you get to pick up his spear, and again, the spear comes with a lightning enchant.
It's interesting, actually. It's a funny story. My housemate was playing this game, and we were talking about the different medieval weapons you find, and he said, well, I found this spear. And I said, oh, spear's a fantastic weapon, by the way. He said, oh, really? I said, oh, yeah, if you think about medieval troop formations and the way they did their mixed unit tactics, spear was pretty much invaluable. And if you think about breaking range, how do you break range against a guy who has a spear because he can chase you down and it's hard to get inside his range, blah, blah, blah. He thought I was saying the best weapon in Dark Souls is the spear. So he went and played with it, and he came back to me and he was like, that spear's junk, man. But, I was just saying it's a good weapon in general.
But spears in this game do have the quality where you can still stab forward while holding your shield
while
up.
While shielding, yeah, it's wonderful. It's awesome, especially if you can get a shield with a good enchantment on it.
So all I'm getting at is it's not really a terrible weapon in this game anyway. Mm. I mean, it's not terribly powerful, but it does have that nice advantage where you can keep shielding and attacking. Obviously, that drains your stamina and leaves you very vulnerable in some cases, but nonetheless, it's an interesting quality that this weapon has that very, very, very few others have.
Yeah, so you can go down a ladder to your left to get down to a little courtyard, but instead, keep going forward. There's some rubble there. The rampart kind of drops off, but if you look down, there is a little platform you can drop down onto. It's like a little semi-hidden area.
Yeah, it looks like you'd probably hit a kill box and die, but you don't. So be aware that you can walk off the ramparts here, right next to the Hayden Knight. And if you go around the edge, you'll find another corpse where you'll pick up a human effigy and a soul of a brave warrior. Now, turn around from here and go over some more rubble, and you'll end up in the courtyard at the bottom of that ladder.
Yeah, there's some dogs and a jailer will fall off a wooden platform. And interestingly, earlier on, before you fall off the rampart, you can snipe him from above and then get onto the rampart. Sorry, the platform he's on, and snipe the dogs that are below. But alternately, those platforms are destructible. So he will eventually fall off and attack you. But if you want to fast track that, you can chop it a few times with your weapon and it'll fall down.
Yeah, once you've done with the enemies in the area, there's another wooden platform, which if you attack a few times, will drop a corpse. And on that corpse, you'll be able to pick up an alluring skull. Now, the alluring skulls are going to be useful for this area anyway, because you'll come across some enemies a little later called undead citizens, and they attack in mobs, and God, they can overwhelm you very quickly. So with the alluring skulls, what you do is you throw them in a direction, and pretty much every enemy will be attracted to them. There's a few exceptions, but most of them will sort of go and attack wherever you threw the skull rather than you, and that allows you to pick them off one by one from behind while they're focused on something
else. So it's similar in that way to the spell Yearn.
Exactly. Now, the item is actually described as being smashed to release traces of souls, and obviously we know all the undead want souls, and so they'll go after the souls.
Yeah. So from the bottom of the ladder, you can go left or right. Now, if you go left and hug the wall that's to your left, which is the wall of the rampart you were just on, you'll find a
chest. At the end.
So you've got to go down a little narrow corridor. So an Esther shard in there, handy little item to have, and also some titanite. So back out into the courtyard and left again, and you'll find a wall lever. Pull the lever, a gate goes up, and you'll find that you're back at Macduff's workshop. So you've just kind of opened up the little shortcut there.
Yeah, precisely. So from Macduff's bonfire, rest if you need to, but go back to where we were in the courtyard where we fought the jailer and the dogs, and go right from the bottom of that ladder. And there'll be a hole in a wall covered by wood. And if you break through the wood, you'll end up into this little room, and there'll be another room adjacent to that. And in that room is where you'll come across those first undead citizens. And as we said, these guys by themselves don't prove terribly difficult. They don't punch hard, but what they do is once they get close to you, they'll jump at you. And if they hit the ground, they'll sort of explode. And most of their power comes from completely diminishing a lot of your stamina. And so if they completely diminish your stamina, you stumble.
And then their mates can come and beat you up.
Yeah, you just lose health in an instant.
Yep. What I thought was interesting about that room that you're in is there's all these archways internally, and I'm not sure why, maybe struts to support the roof, and someone's boarded them up, gone to a lot of effort, all the way up to the top of the arch, boarding up I don't know why you'd board up an arch inside a room and you could just walk around. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, the best I could come up with was maybe using them for indoor archery practice, firing arrows at wood, but it didn't really feel like it fit. So I'm not sure either. I'm just going to put this room down to not having really a purpose. It's just a placeholder to walk through. Now, you can go out a door from here, and this door will be locked if you didn't go from the Tower Apart bonfire. So that's why we hit that area earlier. We got the antiquated key out of that chest, if you remember. And this key will be used to open this door. And if you use it, you will enter into another little courtyard and there'll be a well and some dogs. And if you dispatch the dogs, you'll be able to go up to the well and knock a rock off the ledge, which will raise this massive
cage. Basically, yeah.
Yeah. And there'll be three undead citizens in that cage and they'll attack you again in a group. And if you take out all three of them, one of them will drop the Wanderer set.
That's right. So one thing to note, if you kill them while they're on the platform, which you can do if you're a caster, because your casters have that kind of special ability, the set will drop on the platform. And then you can't get up onto the platform to get it until there is a way to get it, but it's kind of much later in the level.
You know, knee-high ledges and not being able to get over them in this game. What's that about?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. It's like the opposite of the problem with the door and the stormtroopers and Luke Skywalker. But anyway, it's a good idea to at least let them drop off and then kill them.
Yeah.
Now, in the back of that courtyard, there's a room. Around to the right is a ladder, and also there's a door that's kind of in front of you. I think it's kind of better to go up the ladder, sneak in the window, and there's a few guys inside, a swordsman and an archer and stuff.
But if you blow up a powder keg against the wall as you enter through the window, you'll be able to blow a hole in the wall and you'll get to pick up another set, this time the Archdrake robes. Now, the Archdrake robes are worn by the Archdrake sect of Lindelt, and their description says that though little is actually known about the Order, it is said their well-honed miracles and unwavering loyalty in the face of death made them worthy rivals to this country in their day.
I'm interested in that. I'm interested in the different kind of factions that exist. I mean, I wanted to know more about the Balder Knights and all the different factions from the previous game, and it's kind of nice to get these little bits of lore. We know that Lindelt was kind of Miracle City, and it's kind of interesting to see the way that see the armor that they wore and have some descriptions of their activities. There's also a shield.
Yeah, and on that note, the Archdrake sect of Lindelt is sort of surrounded in a bit of mystery. There's not a lot known about it, because you'll also get the shield out of this chest with the robes, and the shield's description says that the secrets of Lindelt rituals are protected by the Archdrake sect, and only a select few are given access to their canon of knowledge, which includes the truthful origins of the Archdrake sect itself.
So here we see a Dranglakean prison created by the King of Dranglake to deal with the curse, populated at least in part by people that are carrying Archdrake armor from Lindelt.
Interesting. Yeah, so I'm not too sure what to make of that yet. There's not a lot of information given. They definitely make it known that you shouldn't know too much about this sect.
Absolutely. So there are some barrels to break, and then you can go through a tunnel and arrive in a large room with a Pharos contraption that we're kind of calling the storage room, because there's a bunch of junk laying around.
Yeah, and in this room, I mean, there's a number of chests and a number of just random items, which some of them are interesting. You'll come across a big statue, and it's an enormous statue of a bearded man in robes, and my first thought was actually that he looks a bit like Zeus.
Oh, the god of Thor?
Yes, yes. So Zeus has made an appearance, but he's holding this scroll and he has this thinnish sword as though it's an S-stock, I would say. I don't know who he is, and he's interesting because he's standing there by himself. He's definitely unique and he has a very particular form to him. He's got a beard and these robes and this scroll, and I'm wondering if maybe he's associated with the Archdrake sect in some way. You know, he's wearing robes, he's got a scroll which are usually associated with miracles. It's interesting.
Yeah.
But then again, we have called it the storage room because there's a lot of random items, and there is another smaller statue of a woman, but there's no details on this statue, so
maybe they just put them there to store them. Yeah, who knows?
Could just be a room full of nothing, and the statue might be nothing in itself. I don't know.
Now, there are some interesting weapons in this room.
Yes, in chests, three of them.
Yeah, the parrying dagger.
This weapon doesn't do a lot of damage, but parrying is a skill in this game that takes a long time to master. The window to parry enemies isn't huge in this game, and so an item like the parrying dagger in your left hand will increase that window. It's a little risky because you don't have a shield in your left hand now. So if you miss a parry, then it means you're going to get hit by whatever weapon they're trying to attack you with.
Mm-hmm.
So for those experienced that want to play around with parrying, go for it. For those a little less experienced, we're going to come across the target shield a bit later in this episode. And that also increases the parry window, but it gives you a shield.
Yeah, and interestingly, the description of the parrying dagger kind of talks to what you're talking about. They're talking about how it's tough to not have a shield, but that's sometimes the way to become stronger. It says, accomplishments are forever out of reach to those who constantly fear failure. A true warrior hones his body and mind and peers far beyond immediate hardship. So what they're saying is, if you want the skills to pay the bills, then maybe you should just do it hard for a little while to develop those abilities.
Yeah, and it took me a number of playthroughs. It was probably only on about my fifth or sixth character in Dark Souls 1 that I actually started to play around with parrying and riposting, which is the very powerful attack that you can do to an enemy once you've parried them. And it took time, but I stuck with it because I didn't have much else left to discover in the game on my fifth or sixth playthrough. And eventually I mastered parrying and I could do it to most enemies most of the time. This game, the parry window seems to be even smaller, so it does take a lot of practice. But with great difficulty comes a long time to master, and with a long time to master comes a lot of replayability. So I like that they include this stuff in the game.
Hmm. Another chest has a twin blade, which I'd never heard of before, so naturally I equipped it straight away, and it's awesome. Like, I don't know how practical it would be, but it's kind of like, you know, Darth Maul's...
Darth Maul, yeah.
Yeah, it's a Darth Maul weapon. You need heaps of dex to use it, yeah. But it's interesting. It looks cool, and it's made from Guy Steel, and it's designed for high-ranking Dranglake knights, hence the decorative design. It says, Guy Steel equipment is of the finest make, but Guy Steel is so rare that very few of these weapons were actually used in combat.
Yeah, so doesn't have a huge amount of damage output, but it's an interesting weapon. Obviously, it's ceremonial of sorts, but you'll come across a few of these dual-edged weapons. Dual-edged? That's not the right word, is it? Double-ended?
Double-ended, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, throughout the game, which is a new weapon class that they didn't have in the previous game, so it's good that they're adding new things. Guy Steel. G-E-I.
Or Gay Steel.
I was going with Gay Steel myself.
Yeah, I think Gay Steel kind of makes more... kind of linguistic sense.
Okay, cool. Either way, one or the other.
Yeah, fabulous steel. Anyway, there's also a bone staff, and the suggestion is, it's a staff for sorceries and hexes. There's the suggestion that it's, you don't have an official education in magic, you kind of have to make your own staff, because you don't have a master to give you one, so you've got to kind of make one out of bones or whatever you can find, and that's what I think they're talking about.
Yeah, the description says, properly trained sorcerers receive their first staff from their master after reaching a certain level of accomplishment. Those without proper training must devise something of their own making, which clearly alludes to this staff. It looks pretty dodgy shit.
So there's also the Pharos contraption in this room. So if you go up and do the old bam right in the kisser, then, you know, that's what it is. You're going to whack it in his mouth. Then it's true.
What was the, what are the kids calling it these days that we came up with earlier?
Oh, banging the anvil or something? Beating the anvil?
Beating the anvil. Carry on.
Then it illuminates two illusory walls, and they're not, just to clarify, we've talked about this before, but you cannot get into those walls unless you activate the Pharos contraption.
Yeah, kind of disappointing. Yeah, you know they're there, you still can't activate them. So, yep, bam, straight in the kisser, two ghostly faces on the wall. Go into both of them. The one on the left will hold a soul vessel in a chest.
Yeah.
The one on the right holds another chest with a wilted dusk herb. And I found it interesting. The one on the left was in a wooden chest and the one on the right was in a metal chest.
Traditionally, the better items are the metal chest, and you'd think that something that allows you to respec your skills is more valuable than something that allows you to cast more spells in a particular instance and then disappears forever. Whatever.
Yeah, I mean, wilted dusk herb is fairly useful. It restores a great deal of spells, so you can do more casts, but you can buy it off people later, so...
Yeah, it's weird. It's a weird one. In that room as well is an elevator cage, which you know will remember from places like Zen's Fortress.
Yeah, it kind of looks like a bit of an Iron Maiden.
Yeah,
but yeah, if you step into it, you know, you raise your courage, it'll close around you and it'll take you up a few levels, and when you get to the top there'll be this corpse. He's interesting. He's in this sort of knelt position with his arms shackled to the wall. He looks like he was in a bit of pain, but you get to pick up your first Skeptic Spice. Now, the Skeptic Spice is an interesting item. You'll come across Simpleton Spices later on in the game, and both of them are used to lower the stat requirements for spells or miracles. In the case of the Skeptic's Spice, a skeptic doesn't have a lot of faith, so it's used to lower faith requirements for miracles.
And a simpleton doesn't have a lot of intelligence, so it lowers the intelligence required for spells and hexes. And it's interesting.
Really cool touch. I like that. So basically with this one, you can't use it immediately. There'll be an NPC that you come across a bit later where you can use your spice to lower the requirements. And it's good because it means that you can figure out what the best spell you want to use is, and basically see how many of these simpleton or skeptic spices you have and then subtract that number from the requirement, and then you only need to level up your character to that level. So if you want to use a spell that requires 50 intelligence and you have 5 simpleton spices, you can go and lower the requirement to 45, which means you don't need to use those extra 5 soul levels to be able to use the spell.
Exactly. So it's pretty handy. Now,
from the elevator, there'll be a door, and we're not going to go out yet. We're going to cover this area next week in Upper Los Bastille. So from here, we're going to go back down, but we're not going to use the elevator. You can see an item sitting on a ledge if you roll off from where you're standing currently. Now, you've got to be careful because you can fall quite a distance and die. But if you do it carefully, you'll be able to pick up a...
Bonfire ascetic. Ascetic? You just wanted me to say...
I did.
Ascetic. Yep. Ascetic.
It's bonfire ascetic.
I think it is, but I'm, you know, I don't know these things. I don't look like an idiot. I'm like some people actually care about whether I look like an idiot.
Yeah, that ship sailed a long time ago for me.
Yeah, so I think you mentioned something to me about how they always put ascetics in hard-to-reach places.
Not always, but yeah, it's interesting to me. You'll come across a couple a little later on, and they tend to be in these really difficult places, but in view. So you want to get them, and you'll go through all these hardships to do them, in this case rolling off a ledge, which you'll probably miss the first couple of times and fall to your death. And when you finally do pull it off, you're like, yes, I get to pick up this new item. What is it? An item to make the game even harder.
Yeah.
How very Dark Souls.
So back down, so you line up your jump with a little narrow stone beam and make sure you land on that, and you will lose some health. But down that way, you can get back into the storage room that we're at before, and you will see that at the opposite end of the room to the end that you entered into, there is a ladder, which leads up to a hole in the wall.
Correct. So go up the ladder, exit the hole through the wall, follow that path. There's nothing along this path of interest, and you'll get to another hole at the end, which allows you to fall back out onto that bridge right next to Macduff's bonfire.
Absolutely.
So go use the bonfire if you need to. Otherwise, we're going to turn right and head a little bit further up the bridge, about 3/4 up from the bonfire, and turn right into that sort of rooftop, which will lead us off to where the boss is.
Yes. Now, at the end of the little courtyard is a steel door. You open it up and you step into the room and you immediately aggro a whole bunch of soldiers. And there's a few of them. I think there ends up being 5. And I actually found them quite difficult. I watched you fight them earlier today with your new character and you did fine. But I actually found that group really difficult. And I found that if you just step just inside the door and quickly leave, you can actually only aggro 3 of them and then aggro the other 2 later, which is how I handled that situation.
Yeah. So if you only put a toe within the door, then you'll only aggro 3 of them. The better way to do it. And it needs to be said that the only reason I had an easier time today was because I was going back at a level 100, which is over-leveled for the area.
I see. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. So, no, they can very quickly overwhelm you, but once you've dispatched them, you can either go left as you enter the door and go into a new area or a new little room where there'll be a couple more and some powder kegs, which you can usually entice them into striking, which will blow them up.
So they want to take a kind of straight line path to you. So you walk in there and there's one kind of on the other side of the powder keg, walk back out the room, and he doesn't have the brains to go around. So he thinks, I'm going to chop this powder keg to get to that guy I saw, and he ends up blowing himself up.
Which is really handy.
Yeah.
And once they're gone, you can pull a lever on the wall and open up another gate. But it's kind of useless because what we're going to do is turn around and go back into the room where you aggroed all those soldiers and head down some stairs into a little lower room and a ladder that leads directly up to the stretch right before the boss. But before you hit that ladder, there's this door in that room.
Yeah, the door to death.
Yeah, I feel like it's another one of those Dark Souls moments. I feel like it's, you walk through that big metal door, you'll get mobbed by 5 of these soldiers, you'll quickly go, shit, 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 they're overwhelming me, and you'll see some stairs, and you'll run downstairs, and then you'll go, oh, there's another door, I'll quickly run through that door, and you'll fall straight to your death,
because it
leads nowhere.
I mean, I agree, but who does that? Who thinks, oh, shit, I'm in trouble, I'm going to go into a new area and make new trouble?
Maybe, yeah.
But yeah, no, I can take your point. I don't know what that door is for. It's just weird.
Well, we're asking who does what. I mean, what architect would put a freaking door?
I mean, I kind of feel like maybe, because it's a long drop, maybe there was like a little something there and then it all chopped off. Because if you look at the whole Bastille, it's just fallen to bits. So maybe Possibly. That bit fell to bits too.
Possibly. So up the ladder and you're in the stretch right before the fog gate. In one of the cells off to the right, you'll be able to summon
Pilgrim Belclair.
If you're human.
And she's actually awesome.
Yeah, she can be quite handy for this fight. She's a caster, and she's very strong as a caster. She does a lot of magic damage.
She also takes a lot of aggro.
Yeah, being that we're about to enter a boss where there's three things to keep track of, having an extra person or another summon can come in handy to keep one of them occupied while you focus on the other.
Mm. So, then you have the opportunity to go and fight the Ruin Sentinels.
How'd you find these guys?
I haven't made any swears this whole episode because I was saving them all for these bastards. They honestly, like, I had a unique amount of difficulty with these bosses and I cannot work out why. It was at the point where I fought them so many times and summoned Belclair so many times that I ran out of effigies, and then fighting them on my own was too difficult, so I went away and did other areas, and I thought, I'm probably strong enough now, I've got a couple more effigies, go back, summon Belclair, lose all my effigies, become increasingly frustrated, go away, do some more areas, come back, fight them again. I finally beat them a long time after, I'm sure I was meant to, just because for some reason I just had so much difficulty with them.
I definitely had difficulty as well, and I think a lot of people do. It seems to be a Dark Souls thing where if there's two enemies in a boss fight or more, you're going to have a hard time.
Yeah. Although, having said that, the Skeleton Lords were just easy as pie.
Yeah, there's a little trick to them, but we'll be coming to them in a few episodes' time. Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, the Ruined Sentinels, three of them. And again, these guys are animated armor.
In fact, the description of the corpse that you obtain at the end of the fight says, Soul of the Ruined Sentinel, a creation of the Jailer. And Jailer has a capital J, it's a proper noun. Who is the Jailer? Nobody knows. The Ruined Sentinel has no corporeal form. It is only an empty soul that haunts the armor. It's a bit Full Metal Alchemist in that regard.
Yeah, and you said who knows about the Jailer. I think we'll come across some things a little later through the episodes that will elucidate a little bit about the Jailer. But yeah, at the moment, we've just got no knowledge on who this could be.
Mm. Interestingly, it's kind of like, whose soul do you get? Like, there's three sentinels, you fight with them, and you get one soul at the end. So is it like one soul split into three, or only one of them has a soul? Or
Yeah, so the three of them, Alicia, Richie, R-I-C-C-E, and Yahim. They all have very, I don't know, Middle Eastern names, I think.
I don't know. Like, Alicia and Richie sound kind of Mediterranean.
Okay.
Whereas Yahim does sound kind of like Middle Eastern, but then again, I don't know.
Anyway, I'm sure it doesn't matter to this game, but yeah, so the three of them are animated by a soul, and I don't know, yeah, is it one soul that animated all three of them, or was that soul broken up? So in any case, they can prove difficult. My advice for this fight is step through the fog gate, and immediately you'll aggro the first sentinel. Now, he'll be up on a ledge with you, and you can take them on one-on-one fairly simply. So with this guy, you don't have a lot of room, but you just sort of keep circling around him, keeping on his back, and attacking him each time he does this big overhand swing, which he's slow to recover from. Eventually, you'll be able to wear him down. And yes. Once you've taken him out, you only have two bosses to deal with.
Sure. So quickly, on that first guy, if he falls off, which he might, because often he steps forward and lunges as he does his attack, he will jump back up, and he will jump back up near to where he fell off. So if he falls off at one end and you rush to the other end, often you will avoid the big sweeping attack he does when he comes back up, which can end you.
Yeah, so the important thing there is if he does fall off, don't think, oh crap, now I have to fall off to follow him. Just wait, he will come back. Now, once you've dealt with him though, the other two aggro, and they will slowly saunter over to where you are, and eventually one of them will jump up as well, and you can then take that one on. I find it, again, easy to take this one-on-one up here, but what you have to keep your eye out for is the third will also eventually jump up. At that point, you're in trouble. So if you do try to deal as much damage to the second up on this ledge as you can, make sure you have full health, because at some point you're probably going to want to bail and jump off this ledge. And when you do, you're going to lose some health.
Mm.
I can't state the amount of times I was doing fine in the fight and end up dying because my health was on a quarter or a third, and I just wanted to get off the ledge, and I just fell to my death.
Yeah. I found as well the sentinels have a particular attack where they kind of hold their hammer out and spin in a big circle.
Mm.
The best way to avoid that, I find, isn't to roll. I untarget them and just sprint away.
Yeah, not a bad idea, because the little spin lasts and covers quite a bit of distance. And if you just stand there with your shield looking at them, you're going to lose a lot of stamina.
It happens, it's bad.
And the second one will just follow up with some big hits and you'll go in an instant.
Mm. But anyway, if you keep distance and play your cards right, you can kill those guys with relative ease and an awful lot of frustration.
Yep. When dealing with the both of them at the same time, the best advice I can give is don't rush it. Just keep your distance, make sure you can see both of them at the same time so one of them doesn't come and blindside you, and just choose your opportunities. Wait for them both to attack at the same time. They'll pause for a moment, go in, hit one, run away again. It will take time, but you'll get there eventually.
All right, so you kill these sentinels.
Yeah, and with their soul, you can actually trade it for a heavy homing soul mass. We're actually going to meet the character that you can trade boss souls with next episode.
So after you've killed the ruined sentinels, the room that they're in, you don't really know it unless kind of savvy to this. It's rich with illusionary walls.
Yeah, six of them in this area. And what you'll notice when you first step out onto the ledge, when you walk into this room for the first time, is there's a corpse on a ledge a couple of meters away from the one you're on with an item that you obviously want to get. But there's no way you can jump across that ledge. And it just sort of sits there taunting you and making you or forcing you to think laterally, like, how do I get this item? And basically the answer is to search for illusory walls. There's many of them in this room. So the first one, drop down from the ledge and directly below the item on the corpse that you saw will be a wall which you can open by tapping A in front of.
So in that room, you will find a ladder. Up the ladder, you'll find a chest. The chest contains the spell Hush. Hush makes you make less noise. I've never found it to be particularly effective.
Yeah, I don't know about it. It's described as the eastern land of Mira is not only the home of proud knights, there is also a traditional order of shadow knights who quietly carry out unspeakable tasks. So it sort of suggests that it's a spell used by these ninjas or whatever they are that carry out these silent kills and whatnot. But for me, I couldn't even sneak up on an undead soldier with this spell.
It's just ridiculous. Who knows? Also, in the room with the chest, there's an illusionary wall. there's a homeward bone on a corpse. So it's not all that fantastic, but you know, you wouldn't know that it was there. You're happy you already found an illusionary wall.
Yeah, that's the corpse you saw on the ledge earlier.
It is.
So if you fall off from here and go around the wall a little bit further.
Going clockwise, right?
Yep, going clockwise on the next wall, a couple of spaces up, is another illusory wall. And in this one will be a target shield in a chest. Now, this is the shield that I was talking about that gives you those extra parry frames while trying to parry enemies. So try using this one out if you want to play around with parrying. This is kind of the area for it, I found. The royal soldiers do quite slow attacks with the Royal Greatsword. So it's not terribly difficult to master parrying these guys. So if you want to play around with it in this area, not bad place to do it.
Yeah, agreed. So continuing around clockwise,
a couple more spaces in the wall up.
Another illusionary wall. And what's inside?
Nothing. Then one spot up from there is another illusory wall. And in this one, you'll find a corpse with a rusted coin. Now, the rusted coins, I don't remember if we've gone over. I think probably the first item we picked up when we entered the game for the first time.
Maybe, yeah. It increases your drop rate anyway. And apparently, it's good to use when you're dealing with Dinah and Teela. You get better drops.
Yeah, so 300 seconds, you'll get more luck when picking up items off enemies, and you'll get better items from the birds.
So, we'll find at the end of the room a small archway, which is the kind of orthodox way out. So, out of that room and up some stairs, an archway on your right, and
if you go left, another illusory wall. So, in this one's the trap. It's just absolute dick around. So what happens is you'll open the wall and see a chest, and your first reaction will be like, Christ, here's the sixth wall, let's run in, grab the chest. And what you won't notice is there's an undead citizen sitting in the corner. And if you go to open the chest, the undead citizen will have enough time to stand up, do their big flop attack, and explode in front of you. And what happens if they explode chests, Church?
You get rubbish.
Yeah. So with this one, the last one, make sure you open the wall and draw the undead citizen out of that room, because you don't want him exploding near that chest. He will ruin whatever item you get out of it, which just happens to be
rogue water.
It's red,
so why can't it be rogue water?
Because it's rouge water.
I actually think rouge might be spelt with a u, r-o-u-g-u-e.
I might have spelled it wrong in my note.
Is it rouge water or is it rogue water?
It's rouge water.
I always called it rogue water.
We'll check.
Well, you know, I've been wrong before. You remember that time when we were young? I was wrong that time?
That one time?
Yeah, it happened that time.
Okay. So this item restores your health and your spell uses. So it's, again, it's one of these items where you're not going to get many of them. You're going to have it in your bloody quick slot. You're never going to use it. Why is it there? It's just muddying the waters. I mean,
yeah,
agreed. Don't give me so many options. I'm just never going to use them.
Now, so back out of that illusionary wall and straight. So this would have been a right turn if you hadn't gone to the illusionary wall. Onto a ledge, and as you follow it around, you'll find another archway.
And go through a small corridor surrounded by jail cells on either side. Very small jail cells, possibly used for, I don't know, solitary. Maybe just solitary or just temporary holding cells. And you'll exit the corridor, but if you're not going fast enough, the last jail cell on the left holds a undead citizen. And this guy won't hesitate to explode in your face as you walk out.
And he's unique.
Yeah, he's the only one that does fire damage, and he does a lot of it. And he also disappears when he explodes. So, again, the only one that does that.
Yeah, and you got killed in a very interesting way by him. Some dick left a message.
Oh, yes. God, so I'm cautiously walking through this corridor and I haven't picked up that he makes noise, and there was a soapstone message and it's a new area. And as I do with every new area, as I'm slowly walking into it, I check all the soapstone messages on the way to prepare myself. Some dick put one right in front of his cell that just said, "Here." Blammo. What a pain in the ass, because he does a lot of damage and he kills you in one hit a lot of the time, and little to you know at this point, but less than 10 meters away is a bonfire.
Yep. So the last bonfire that we're going to cover right now, the Servant's Quarters bonfire, and then for the Lower Bastille, you're done.
Correct. So that's it for the Lower Lost Bastille. Next week, as I said, we're going to cover the Upper Bastille and Belfry Luna and Sinner's Rise. All right, so I didn't actually like our original question of the week this week, so I'm going to make it official. We want to see your tips. Let us know the things that you wish you knew as a new player. For our experienced players out there, this will be a good opportunity for you to share your knowledge and welcome the newer players to the community. And we'll be sure to shout out for any community tips that we use.
Okay, thank you for listening. We've been the Dark Souls 2. Oh, you hate that we've been, don't you?
Yeah, we're always the Dark Souls 2.
I know, we've been the Dark Souls 2 for a while. Yeah, well, anyway, thank you.
See you next week.
Halo.
You idiot. That was a very abrupt ending.
Yes.
The Dark Souls 2 has been a Screaming and Digital production. For show notes, please visit thedarksouls2.com or join the community at facebook.com/thedarksouls2. You can also contact us via info@thedarksouls2.com. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please leave a review on iTunes or spread the word. Our theme tune is The Knights of Darkness by Zero Project.
What are the different names for a pier? Like pier, wharf, dock, jetty.
Key.
Row, row, row your boat gently to the quay. When you look for your rowboat, where the fuck could it be? That was the worst of them all.
Yeah.
I honestly, I will.
That one gets cut.
Yeah, get rid of that one. Good. I don't want that one there.